This is a special episode of Paranormal Patio with me, Jason. I have a special introduction. We are being hosted in the wonderful Mystere Creations patio of the North, the cold, bitter climate of partial communism. No, I'm kidding. Of Canada, our lovely neighbors to the North, and our lovely friends, Sarah and AJ of Mystere Creations, are sponsoring this episode that you're about to hear. So I'm going to bring them in and let them talk a little bit about Mystere Creations. Hey guys, thanks for hosting us in your patio.
Glad to be here.
Yeah.
I know that I've had both of you on. Technically, I had AJ on as a guest, but Sarah made an appearance towards the end of that episode. So yeah, welcome back, both of you. But you know, official welcome for Sarah, who we're going to be talking to about some of her research in an upcoming episode. So make sure you keep coming back for more. Tell us a little bit about Mystere Creations. I know we've talked about it before, but what can people expect who have maybe never heard of Mystere Creations?
Mystere Creations is a podcast and archive in which we preserve cultures, history, science, and folklore.
And fight stupidity through education and knowledge.
Yeah, essentially.
I love that. I love that. You have to fight the stupidity on any level that you can in every aspect of life. So absolutely. You know, thank you again, guys, for becoming sponsors for the Patreon. And your long-standing support on Patreon, you guys may have been like number two or three that signed up for the Patreon. So you've been here with me for a very long time. And, you know, we communicate a lot. I'm really bad on Facebook Messenger because I don't check it very often. I don't use it for personal use that much anymore. But I do get back to you guys whenever I check it. And we've been talking a lot lately because of our upcoming work together. What are we going to be talking about in the next episode of Paranormal Patio?
The counties in Illinois called Weird Egypt, or they're called Egypt, but the book is called Weird Egypt because they are very strange.
Very strange indeed. Mostly because if you go down there when I'm around, you're going to see this giant hairy mess just lumbering through the forest. And you're going to think, man, that's probably a Bigfoot. But no, it's just me, the host of your favorite paranormal podcast, A Paranormal Patio, just lumbering through the woods. But I have a feeling we might even talk about some Bigfoot stuff whenever we get to talking about that in the next episode.
Definitely.
There wasn't a lot of Bigfoot encounters in this. And I think it's because he's coming from a more skeptical science. But I mean, there's just all kinds of weird things. Like in one county, there was a guy who was in his car, heard a sound, and it moved through his car, shut his car down, and then moved on. So like, there's a lot of weird stuff.
Yeah, for sure. One of my favorite Bigfoot stories comes from the Little Egypt area, and that's the big muddy monster. And I know that that's in there because Murfreesboro is, I think it's on the western side of the Shawnee Forest, but the big muddy monster we'll definitely cover. And the good news is, in preparing for this episode, I mean, the copious notes that you have taken for this project, I can't thank you enough because this book is incredibly rare, hard to find. You have a copy. And you're making this document full of notes for everyone who doesn't have it. Hopefully it can be shared in the future. The Murfreesboro Mud Monster, I know, is in the book, and I'm really looking forward to it. And there's so much that we're going to talk about in multiple episodes, potentially. So if we don't cover something that you know about in Southern Illinois, which frankly, I mean, most people probably don't know that much about Southern Illinois, unless you live there. You know, there's all kinds of weird stuff, like you mentioned. And we're going to cover a lot. We're going to try to cover as much as we can.
As long as it takes.
So we'll have a good time. And of course, you know, you guys can definitely go over and check out Mystere Creations and, you know, subscribe everything. Guys, where can people find Mystere Creations?
You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon, even though I didn't want it to be on Amazon.
And Instagram.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. Oh, and of course, Facebook, of course. Yeah, you guys just dropped some new merch not that long ago. Big stuff. Yeah, we look forward to more Mystere Creations in the future for sure. But I want to take this time to thank you guys so much for being a part of my Patreon and for the support and, you know, stopping in and letting us host this episode with the one and only Kyle Cadell right here in Paranormal Patio.
You're listening to the Paranormal Patio Podcast. Pull up a chair. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Paranormal Patio. Please join me in welcoming back my good friend Kyle Cadell from the International Paranormal Museum and Research Center in Somerset, Kentucky. And excuse me for the nasally sound of my voice as I am currently battling a sinus infection, which is just the best time. At any rate, we have something serious to talk about today, which is why I want to talk to Kyle. And we'll get into that. But first, I'd like to have Kyle revisit what the museum is and what it means, because we had him on the show back in, way back in season two. And I really want to present this to maybe you haven't listened to all the old episodes. And, you know, you need to get on the same page and talk about the museum and learn what it is, why it is, and how important it is before we get into this emerging controversy. So, all that being said, Kyle, welcome back to the Paranormal Patio.
Hey, Jason, how's it going, man?
You know, this sinus infection sucks. I've had two this year, and the first one.
Oh, geez.
The first one, I felt awful, but this one, I don't feel bad. I just am tired of blowing my nose, really, and having my voice affected. But you know, at least I'm not like feeling sick. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway,
that's at least an upgrade.
It is an upgrade, but I would rather just not have any of it, you know?
Right. I actually took one of my cats to the vet this week and he had to be given a shot because he also has a sinus infection currently. And it's kind of strange that even cats can get them, you know?
They certainly can. And they'll sneeze and it's, you know, it's sad to see a cat that you know is sick, but it's kind of funny and cute when they sneeze too.
Yeah. Poor little Flash. He's always trying to clear his throat of something. And it's like, what the hell are you doing, buddy?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, my cat was sick a few months ago, like, and didn't eat for 3 days, and it's like, man, this is not good. Like, it's time to call the vet, you know. And then she just totally came out of it and she was totally fine. So who knows? Anyway, yeah, welcome back to the show. Like I had mentioned before, I really want to cover this emerging controversy, but I don't want to spoil it because I think it's important to talk about your museum and fill people in who may not be aware of it, you know, what kind of things they can find in there. And, you know, you've had some recent accolades, you know, to put on your awards mantle as well. I'd like for you to talk about. So we'll get into all of that. But first off, man, I love Somerset. And when I come down to visit, I always stop in at the museum, whether you're there or not. And mostly, you know, it's like 50-50, but you usually show up whenever, you know I'm there. And
yeah,
it is just, it's always priority for me to stop by the museum, usually pick up another shirt, because I gotta say, your shirts are still the best shirts around. So
well, thank you.
So I gotta go in, I gotta pick up a shirt, and then I have all of them. I'm starting to rebuy them in the next size down, which is great. And I just rocked your hoodie this weekend too, the glow in the dark UFO hoodie, which is terrific.
Heck yeah. The hoodie is made, so we usually go with this one certain company for our shirts. Like, one of their artists, Tyler, is a guy I work with that, like, we've made all the monster shirts and everything together. But that hoodie is actually, we went with a whole different company and artist here locally. And those people, their company is named American Screen Printing, but they're known locally because they're a band. They're a band that started a screen printing company, and they're called the Vibrolas. And the Vibrolas is like this awesome, like, kind of old school punk band that has been together for like 20 years locally. And so the lead singer and his wife are the two main members of this band and the two people that run the screen printing business. So it's, number one, really fun to do business with them. But number two, like, all of our shirts have kind of the same look. Like, the Tyler, our regular artist that we work with, I love the monster designs that he does. But he was trained in, like, how to make a sign, you know? So all of the monsters shirts and like our like logo of Nessie being abducted and everything, they all have the kind of look of like 2 to 3 colors at most and big, bold, like, lines. Something you would make as a sign for a business almost is how that art's done. And I love the look, but I wanted to go with something completely different for those hoodies. We released those for the 5-year anniversary party we had last October. We didn't think we'd be around for a full year, and we surpassed 5 years in October. We're at like 5.5 now. So,
yeah, big congratulations for that.
Thank you very much. Like I said, never thought it would happen, but here we are. So we wanted to do a hoodie release because we hadn't had hoodies in like 4 years. We wanted to do a hoodie release of a new design that looked completely different. And so I just contacted the Vibrolas. I was like, hey, let's do hoodies and whatever you want to do. Like, I gave them zero art. I didn't even give them a copy of our logo. I gave them no like instructions. I said, do what you want to do for this hoodie that will be our 5-year anniversary release hoodie. And so he did this fucking killer design of it was inspired by the Stanford abductions that happened about a half hour from where our museum is, up in Stanford, Kentucky, in the, I want to say 60s. I can't remember right offhand. It was either 60s or 70s, but it was these three women that were abducted out of their vehicle. And so he did a shirt inspired by that for our hoodie. And it looks awesome, man. It glows in the dark where the, that is the one direction I gave him, that it would be cool if it glowed in the dark. So
yeah, it'd be cool if it glowed in the dark.
Yeah. It's like, doesn't have to, but, so of course it does. It's a UFO abducting a car full of people. And like the aliens are like kind of comic-y. Like one of them is like flashing inside the UFO and stuff. So it's definitely different than anything else we did, but it's so awesome and it's perfect for us. We're actually going to have him design our next shirt too. Honestly, I don't know if this makes for interesting content, but we're thinking about getting about 5 more monster designs, but then pushing all of the monster designs, the new ones and the old ones, over to a print on demand company so that it's actually, it will be like a subsidiary of the museum called Cryptid Couture Company.
Oh.
It will just make these monster shirts and it'll be print on demand, so we'll be all hands off on it. And we are thinking about just focusing on our own merch from now on because, as we'll get to in the controversy, there may be a day that the museum doesn't exist physically, so at least for a while. So we want to have some revenue sources that aren't tied directly to the physical location. So we're going to probably move those to on demand, and then we're going to have the Vibrolas design us a new t-shirt and maybe even do another t-shirt from our normal artist Tyler, to where we'll have like 4 or 5 like museum shirts and stickers and all that line, and move the monsters over to like a common thing, you know.
I dig it. Then, you know, I'm gonna have to find somewhere else to pick up a shirt whenever I come down to Somerset every time.
Exactly. Well, hopefully, if the print on demand works out well, I want it to be in like those weirdo gift shops that you go to in tourist towns where they have like offbeat things, you know, like that company that makes like Titanic shaped ice cube molds and stuff like that. Those places that have those weird things. I want our t-shirts to be able to be kind of universal like that. And like disassociating from our physical location at the museum is a good way to do that, you know?
It is. I'll just have to go, what's the little candy shop there? Like just beside your museum.
Oh, the Mole Hole.
I'll have to go to the Mole Hole and get a shirt whenever I come down.
Yeah, I've actually talked to Tammy about designing shirts for them that weren't like for the museum, which is like Lake Cumberland, Kentucky. And it's like a pretty like vista of Lake Cumberland, but then like a little Nessie head sticking out, you know, just like shirts that are not necessarily for the people that are into my museum, but that they're quirky enough that like normal people would buy them, you know.
She didn't bite on that.
She thinks it's a good idea, but you know, I'm just full of those good ideas and then never follow through on them. You know how I am.
I've met you before, but one good idea that you did follow through on was starting this museum up, and I'm not alone in feeling that way. You have just been featured on Roadside America as a weekly highlight, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this may just show my nerdiness, like my nerdy side a little bit more, but I consider this accolade, this honor, to be like the thing I'm most proud of with my museum, more than like being in Hellier that like 3 million people have seen so far or whatever. Those things are so cool. My whole life, especially like I really started doing road trips around like 2014, 2015. Not to get too deep into my personal life, but I had this disease that caused me to have, it's called avascular necrosis, and eventually I had to get a hip replacement. And so for like 2 or 3 years, I couldn't like walk or, you know, casually do anything. And it got to me like mentally. So after I had a hip replacement, and I'm, you know, completely mobile again, I got really into traveling the country and just doing road trips and like going wherever I can to see whatever I can, weird stuff. And this is obviously one of the big inspirations for the museum. So one of the biggest resources I would use for my traveling for the road trips is a website and an app called Roadside America. And Roadside America collects the best of all of the quirky attractions in the nation and in Canada, in all of North America, and like puts them into the app to and helps you like plan your trips. So it's not just like, you know, paranormal weird things like my museum or the Mothman Museum or the Bigfoot Museum in Georgia or like of the ilk, but it is like anything that is classic nostalgia roadside America, the kind of things you think about when you think about a 60s road trip along Route 66. So it's things like the muffler men statues in the world. It's things like the largest ball of twine. I've once seen a sign outside of a beer stop called the coldest beer in USA. And that sign is on Roadside America. So it's like the offbeat weird stuff that makes this country the great thing that it is. They started it as a book in 1994. And back then, a lot of this like nostalgic roadside quirkiness was going, you know, the way of the buffalo. It was gone. And so they were trying to preserve what there was left. And that was 1994. In 1996, they launched the website. And now in 2023, not only was it so successful in preserving the memories of these places, but it has inspired a generation of these places like me, to where I have used this road, this app, the Roadside America app, to plan all these trips and see, you know, a drive-through art museum in Alabama that is all inside of shipping containers from tractor trailers and is open 24 hours, or the Abita Springs Mystery House, or hell, like one of my favorite like quirky things is mystery water sources. Like stories, like springs or something that have stories about either God giving this water to people or people drinking this water and being healed. The Roadside America has a whole like section like dedicated to miracle water, you know? And so when I first opened the museum back, we opened on October 14th, 2017. Someday in the weeks leading up to that, the first social media thing I did was make an account on Roadside America, because I was like, this Roadside America has pushed me to all these great places. I wanted to push people to my museum. And I, you know, just a little personal thing that meant a lot to me. And then here we are 5.5 years later. We've come what feels full circle, because Ken Smith, who is the senior editor for the Roadside America website and one of the original authors to the book, called me and he's like, "Hey, man, I'm coming through Kentucky and I really want to stop at your museum." And so he came through. He spent like 2 or 3 hours. He was in this super manic state because it was like the last stop on like a 2 or 3 week road trip for him. So he's like, you know, all frazzled. And he was very alive when he was doing the tour and everything. And then we did a follow-up phone call interview. He's like, "Hey, man, I'm just so sorry. Like, I know I probably even talked more than you did. I was like really hyped up, you know."
It probably made you feel good, though, that he was hyped up and, you know, in it.
Yeah, he really, yeah, he seemed like, just if I wouldn't have known who he was, I would have just thought, "Oh man, this guy's really into going to places like this, because he would be like, oh yeah, you have the stuff from the Mothman Museum. I was just at the Mothman Museum a few weeks ago. Oh, and you have this. This reminds me of the, you know, the place in Kansas, the Blades House of Curiosities, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, man, this guy's awesome. Just based on that. But yeah, he checked everything out and like just made me feel good, because like he got the museum in a way that I think most people that go through it don't get, but it's in the way that I get it, like where I've been to so many of these similar type places that's what kind of the feeling that I want to give with it. And he definitely picked up on that. And then did a interview, phone call interview with me, and let me know I was going to be featured as the Roadside America Site of the Week. So every week, Roadside America has a different top site of the week that they recommend you going to. And it's usually one that they've been to themselves. And it's like the first thing you see on the website. And after that week, it gets permanently archived in the Site of the Week thing. So everyone always sees it. A lot of people that are like Roadside America junkies, like have the update set to where like they try to go see, like as soon as they announce the new place, they add it to their list of places to see if they haven't been yet, you know? And so we were named as Roadside America's Site of the Week. Over 150,000 people use the site, like individual people use the site or website annually to plan their trips. Being named the Roadside America site, we anticipate we're going to get at least 10,000 more visitors this year, or 5,000 to 10,000 more visitors this year, which we have been there for 5 years, and we've hit just over 15,000 visitors recently. So this is going to be a big bump for us, you know? If we can still host them, you know,
we keep teasing these things. We'll get to it. We'll get to it. I know that Roadside America is not the only like cool visitor that you've, you know, had come to the museum. Somebody that I've watched online for quite some time, and early on, before I'd even really talked to you in person, I was on YouTube and found the carpetbagger that goes around kind of like Roadside America, really, and goes to just, you know, weird out of the way things all over the country. He had come and done a video in the museum, and I thought that was cool. And I know you've had other, you know, notable people come in. You have any that you'd like to share that you find interesting?
Yeah, I specifically, Jacob the Carpetbagger was awesome. He's been to the museum twice. One of those times was in before we did our remodel in the pandemic, and one was after. And after his first visit, we actually had someone from West Virginia contact us and donate a piece of the concrete pillar support beam from the Silver Bridge that had collapsed. So in our museum now, we have a piece of the Silver Bridge, and it's completely because the carpetbagger came through. And so, like, that's one of my favorite interactions we've ever had with any of these, like, you know, famous people or people that are bloggers or anything, because it led to one of my favorite pieces in the museum, you know?
One of my favorite pieces, too. It's my second favorite now. It was my first. But now,
what's your first favorite?
Well, the last time I was down, I happened to see a bottle of hot sauce with the paranormal patio spooky garlic back near the Hellier section. And I thought, wow, that is just amazing. And so that's my favorite piece now. But, you know, maybe that's just selfishness. So I'll bump it down to two, and we'll say the Silver Bridge piece is
again. You said, wow, how did they get their hands on that?
I know. Incredibly limited run. I mean, the fact that there's one in the museum, just, you know, it almost brought a tear to my eye. Then I realized it was because I had subconsciously kind of crawled into the glass case and I was smelling it. And that was what the tear was from, because it's basically napalm. But
it is much hotter than I thought it would be.
yeah, it is. And it's good though. It's a good flavor. It's not just hot.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, I'm shilling my own swag here. That's not what I'm trying to do.
I love it.
You have someone from IBM or no, it wasn't IBM. It was like some big company that came through not long ago, and they were on the phone the whole time.
Oh, yeah. It was the CEO of Stuckey's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stuckey's was in America what Buc-ee's is becoming. You know, the ultimate like gas stop, pit stop for anything you do. You know, there's so many Stuckey's locations, especially in the South, where it's just, you know, along every interstate exit ever. And the Stuckey's, she was in town because our Chamber of Commerce had booked her to talk at a luncheon meeting, apparently. And she mentioned in her thing about how much she loves like the roadside culture. And so one of my friends that was there said, hey, you should go check out the museum. And so she came in. Of course, my employee didn't know who she was, but was irritated because she was just on the phone the entire time that she went through the museum. I went in that day to tell my employee that the CEO of Stuckey's came in. And she's like, God, there's this woman that just wouldn't shut up. It ended up being her. And so I told her that. She's like, oh, well, I guess it makes sense that she was busy, you know?
Yeah. Getting the work done.
But yeah, we had her. My favorite people that we've actually developed relationships with through the museum is Geraldine Sutton Stith, whose father was Lucky Sutton, who fought off the Hopkinsville Goblins.
So
Geraldine's been through the museum a couple times. Now, almost every time that she goes to an event like for the Hopkinsville Goblins, she'll pack our museum Hopkinsville Goblins shirt and wear it. And just so funny. And she's personally donated stuff. And like, they're just wonderful people.
She is such a sweetheart. I interviewed her for one of my Hair Raising Horror Weeks. I think it was season 2's Hair Raising Horror Week. Man, she is just so nice.
Yeah, she's like down to earth and doesn't have qualms about repeating that story that everyone ever has made her repeat. You know, And she's so good at telling it, and she's so good at still having the charm in telling that story for the 1,000th time, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So when the pandemic started, we actually before had an idea to start a storytelling podcast similar to like The Moth, but have it recorded live at the upstairs of our building. The museum is in the downstairs of the Cooper Community Arts Center in Somerset, which is an over 100-year-old building that started as the post office and then became the library, and then about 11 years ago became the Carnegie Community Arts Center. If it wasn't for this art center, we would have never been able to open. They gave us the first, like, they gave us cheap rent. They gave us the first spot. They allowed us to open as a small business locally, and the upstairs is used for events and stuff. You can rent it out. So we had a plan to do event, like rent it out for event space and have just live storytelling nights where we had like 3 or 4 people that submitted stories and were approved, and then like someone I booked, like Geraldine or like one of the Ghost Hunter guys or Cliff Brockman from Finding Bigfoot or someone there just to tell a story. And so we would have theme nights about like one night would be about fairies. One night would be about Bigfoot. One night would, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then we do a recording of those live told stories and release it in a podcast format like The Moth. I still really like that idea, but when I was starting to implement it, Geraldine was the first one to agree. Our first episode, it was going to be about goblins. And I'd gotten a few other people locally to agree with it. And we were just starting to plan it when the pandemic happened. That's on the still on the back burner somewhere, but I'd like to get that going. But I still think it's a great idea. But yeah, she agreed to do the first one to tell the story of her father fighting off the goblins.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't really care what your belief on it. On the credibility of it is, it's an incredible story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've struggled with it too. Like if, and I think I even talked with Geraldine about it because I'm sure she's heard every possible criticism at this point of the story. But like, if they made it up to get rich, well, they didn't get rich. In fact, it was the complete opposite. They were totally ridiculed and basically laughed out of their community. And it's not like she's rich from it. You know, she retells it because people want to hear it, you know? So I don't know. I don't think they made it up.
In our collection of stuff about the Hopkinsville Goblins, we have a bottle of moonshine over there because about 5 miles away from the farm where the Hopkinsville Goblins encounter happened, now is the Casey Jones Distillery. Casey Jones was a famous bootlegger bottle runner during Prohibition. A lot of the moonshine that the mob in Chicago sold came from Casey Jones's bootleg moonshine distilleries. So the grandson of Casey Jones now runs a distillery on his grandpa's farm there, about 5 miles away from the goblin encounter, you know? And so I went after the solar eclipse. The solar eclipse happened 1 year on the same weekend anniversary of the Hopkinsville Goblin encounter.
Yeah, yeah.
We went, the festival happened. We were at the festival while the eclipse happened. It was actually really amazing. And then down the road, the Casey Jones Distillery had their own solar eclipse thing and bottled a specific bourbon or a specific moonshine for the event. So the next year when I came into town for it, I went and toured the Casey Jones Distillery, ended up buying a bottle of the moonshine that was bottled the day of the eclipse for the event and had Casey Jones sign it. So that's just a long story to say that's in my Hopkinsville Goblins. Well, when Geraldine and her husband came through at one point, when they're looking at the goblin stuff, her husband says, "Is that a bottle of moonshine in there?" I said, "Yeah." And I did a, abbreviated version of that story to him. And he goes, "A lot of people have accused Lucky of being drunk that night. So I don't know how well that looks." I was like, "Oh, I never meant it that way." That they were drinking moonshine and saw the goblins. And then Geraldine actually specifically said that their grandmother, her grandmother, who was the owner of the house that they saw the goblins at, never let anyone drink inside the house. So there was no drinking going on at all that night because she was like a very, very strict Christian woman. So there's absolutely no drinking going on that night, which is one of the many things that are usually included in that story. Like sometimes people say the police found a bunch of beer cans or something. It's like, no, absolutely nothing like that happened, which adds even more credibility, in my opinion, to the encounter, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That is kind of funny to think about that. You kind of inadvertently gave ammunition to the skeptics there with your display.
Yeah. Slightly suggested.
Well, I mean, for what it's worth, I didn't put two and two together any of the times that I've, been to the museum. So maybe I'm just oblivious, but I didn't think about it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that fits in. We have a lot of we have a Rougarou themed rum, the Rougarou's the Cajun werewolf. And we have several beers that are different, like Ghostbusters beers or like the Swamp Lake soda or something like that. So it's just part of that. Obviously the museum, we're serious in some aspects, but also we appreciate the kitschiness of these stories and of pop culture. And we don't want to take ourselves too seriously because it's not that I think everything's a joke, but I think that what's more important than the actual facts of a Bigfoot encounter is the effect that it's had on society and pop culture and folklore. That's really what we cover with everything. We have goofy things like a bag of chips from Britain that are alien themed or a soda that says it's called alien snot, totally goofy and not even pretending that it's worth true investigation or something, but it's just an interesting commentary on how much the not real, quote unquote, has permeated through our society,
Yeah, absolutely. I've always enjoyed that aspect of your museum because, like you said, you have, serious aspects, from multiple different cases of paranormal encounters and investigations and tons of research and a reading room where you can look at books on, tons of different topics that are, related to the artifacts that are in the museum. But at the same time, there is the fun of you're looking through, Bigfoot casts, and then there's, a can of corn or something, that's relevant, like Bigfoot corn. That's not a real thing. I made that up for the interview.
We do need to start a Paranormal Patio canned Bigfoot corn.
Oh, man, that'd be easy to do. Easy to do. Just cut the label off an already existing can of corn, print a new one, and boom.
Yeah, right? Boom. Just don't tell Dole or whoever canned corn you go with.
You know, like, what are they going to do? Test it. It's going to come back as corn. It's not like they do anything special to it. It's corn. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but the Jolly Green Giant might come up to your house and you don't want to fuck with him.
That's true. Like, maybe he's a cryptid. Like, can we classify the Jolly Green Giant as a cryptid that no one's uncovered yet? Like, he's just a mascot.
Yeah, I think officially he is now a cryptid. You know?
Perfect. Perfect. Moving on.
He is kind of like Green Man reminiscent.
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, like a Green Man and a Sasquatch sort of thing combined, you know?
We need to start describing him. In high school, me and my friends used to like say, oh, I hate this guy that we're friends with because he's, and then we would slowly just start describing characteristics of Alf and pretending it's things that our friend did. Like, oh yeah, I hate Billy. He fucking wears Hawaiian shirts all the time. And he never leaves the house. And man, he ate my friend's cat. So we would do that constantly. That was an ongoing joke. So we need to start doing that with the Jolly Green Giant, like in serious like circles. Like, yeah, well, I was recently reading about this cryptid that's like 18 feet tall, green.
Yeah. And sometimes there's a smaller one that travels with it. Sometimes it's seen, but it was more seen in the 90s than it is now. But
yeah, it's super big on vegetables. Yep. Apparently that's what they eat. But how many vegetables does it need to maintain, you know?
Oh, man, just, that's the real mystery, Kyle. That is the real mystery behind us. Yeah, like we talked about you know, the piece of the Silver Bridge. Can you just like highlight a few of the, you know, you probably get tired of doing this, but a few of the, like, I don't know, more interesting or notable artifacts that you have in the museum for someone who hasn't had the chance to come down and experience them with their own eyes?
Yeah, so this might be not one of the most notable, but this kind of falls in line with what we were just talking. The newest thing that I put in there, like I said, I've been going through, my mom passed away recently. I've been cleaning out her house and getting stuff ready for like donations and stuff. And in one of her boxes of stuff, we used to collect Barbies for her, where every Christmas we'd get her like the Christmas edition Barbie. And she was, my mom was a nurse, so we would get her like the nurse Barbies. She had this whole collection that she used to have on display. And so I was getting ready that a lot of the stuff of hers that I'm not keeping, we're donating to the local Humane Society that she volunteered for, because they go through and sell it at different fundraisers. And so it's, you know, just to help support the charity that she always worked with. So I was going through the box of Barbies, and I actually found a box that is Barbie and Ken dressed as Mulder and Scully.
Oh.
And that's a Barbie set I bought her. It was from 1998. So I bought her that when I was like 12 years old for Christmas, when I loved X-Files and when she loved X-Files and was in the middle of collecting Barbies.
How perfect.
And so I went ahead and grabbed that out, and that is our newest display piece in the museum. Again, that's not something necessarily that like is one of a kind or something you would want to travel 10 hours to see, but it is a perfect example of the weird permeation of the other into the most mundane mm-hmm. aspects of regular life. Barbie is the epitome of like feminine energy and like feminine toys for this materialistic world we live in. And here is Barbie dressed as Scully next to Ken dressed as Mulder. And just because people liked a TV show, now here is this epitome of like feminine worth that women since the 50s have strived for as little kids, dressed as someone that's investigating aliens, you know?
Yeah.
That's just so bizarre and so on point for exactly the kitschiness that and like pop culture value that I think we can expand on when we talk about this stuff. I don't think that things have to be viewed in the serious lens that it's viewed in, because as I've talked about, I think that personal energy and person and mental readiness to see these things depend on the person. And so the more that you can permeate ideas like that into all of every aspect of reality, the more likely it is that the average person in reality will experience unreality, you know?
It's like my words coming out of your mouth. It's eerie.
But yeah, that's absolutely not at all an answer to, to your question, but I find it fascinating. But yeah, so to answer your question, so we cover a little bit of everything. We have a pretty broad term of paranormal. A lot of people just think ghosts or ghost hunting when they hear paranormal. And we kind of think of anything above the normal, out of the normal. So we cover, you know, ghosts, Bigfoot, aliens, voodoo stuff, psychic ability, serial killers. We have oddities, just death related stuff, miracle water. Like I've said, we have a little bit of everything for people. Some of my favorite things are, my favorite haunted item we have is a mannequin named Gladys. And Gladys, just to tell a very short version of the story, she was left over in a store here locally that used to be a clothing store and was a bookstore at the time. They had moved her to a separate area in the store that was going to be basically permanent storage. It was going to be the death of her. They'd never see her again. And so they move her there. And obviously she didn't like it, because in an 8-month period after that, there's 10 separate times where the employees locked up at night. And when they got there the next morning, Gladys had moved to a different location in the store. My favorite out of all those stories is this bookstore used to do gaming event nights. And one night they had a bunch of gamers there. A woman left to go use the bathroom in the back and turn on the lights. And Gladys was just standing there in the middle of the bathroom. Obviously, the employees did not enjoy that. We knew the owner of the store, or I knew the owner of the store, and she asked us to take her out. And so she's been in the museum ever since. And we just yesterday had a couple visit. We've had multiple people say that they've seen her wink or blink or even move. But yesterday we had a couple visit. And after they had left, they were in the car talking about Gladys. And the husband had said that he felt like he absolutely saw her eyes move and felt like she was creeping on him the whole time. And then they noticed a series of scratches on his neck that was in the shape of a heart. And she took pictures of it and like sent it to our Facebook and everything. So Gladys is still all these years later causing trouble for people to come through. That's, you know,
really interesting, man.
Yeah, it was. I'll have to show you the message. But like, it was really cool, because literally the people right before that, was this guy that came in. He definitely has to be a YouTuber or a podcaster or something. He had like a professional camera, was filming the whole thing. He had an EMF detector, and he like interviewed Hannah, my employee, for a couple questions. And so like he was in there actively stirring stuff up. And this next couple that like in their they're casual fans. They saw Hellier a few times, and that's why they were there. Like, they're not active ghost hunters or anything like that. And so they came in right after him. And that's when all of that happened with him. So it's really interesting, you know, that like even in a hands-off setting, I can still observe the activity that happens based on the people that come through's energy.
Yeah, yeah. You know what would be really neat, and you might have considered this, or maybe you've even tried it, I don't know. What if you had 24/7 webcams set up in the museum in different areas?
Okay, I do.
Okay.
I have the Wyze camera set up. Originally, the plan was to have, I have one of the panning cameras that move and track motion. I have those set up on the ghost hunting, or on the haunted and cursed objects. And originally, years ago when we were doing the remodel, Darren and I started building an app out so that it would be like a companion tour, like tour guide app for visiting the museum. But I wanted to have all these other things. Like, we have my friend Phil that wrote the soundtrack for Pennyroyal. Mm-hmm. We had him start writing us a soundtrack for the museum. And like, he actually did some awesome stuff, like took audio recordings of Bigfoot eyewitnesses encounters and like slowed them down and sped them up and like made them into music and stuff.
That's cool.
So we had him working to where you could just listen to that, his album all the time on the app. But then we also had where you could watch the live stream of the pan and scan photo at any time and then have like a report incident button to where you could just like, it will be like a basic contact form with a timestamp and you'll say what you saw. That's kind of, again, fallen by the wayside. The camera's in there right now, but we don't do... we don't have it broadcasting or anything.
Well, you're really missing an opportunity there, man. You know, like people would pay $2.99 a month to become gold level members of the Paranormal Museum if they could watch a live stream of the Ghost Room 24/7.
I know. And it's that again, all falls into, we have another idea for museum memberships that would basically just work through Patreon. And that would be one of the reward levels. But here I am just, you know, dropping the ball.
Well, you know, you talk to people like I am, you know, talking to you now, just sitting here, and you could have been working.
Exactly. Shame on me.
No, I kid. But, you know, I would definitely be on board for becoming a, you know, like a premium member of the museum for sure, man. That's a great idea. So we've talked about the museum, and I don't know if you can even answer this without feeling weird, but like, what do you think the most important aspect of your museum is? What do you feel like it provides for the public, and you know, why you think it's important to have around?
So there's a few different things that I think, as most of what we've talked about is fun. I really enjoy having a want to do business, not a need to do business, not something like the electric company where you have to go in begrudgingly and give so much money and blah, 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 or Walmart where you have to go get groceries and be mad that eggs are $8 a carton or whatever. I want to provide a want to do business where anyone that has free time or is on a trip or is just curious can stop in, hang out, and do something entirely out of the rest of the ordinary realm of their life. I want you to come in, if whether you're a local or you've traveled here on a road trip and just saw it on Roadside America, or you're obsessed with the paranormal stuff and need to come here as some sort of mecca or something. You know, I want whoever you are to be able to come in and forget about reality and bills that you pay and things that you have to do for work, just for the half hour to 2 hours or whatever that you spend in my museum. Even if it's not the best experience of your life, I want you to have one of the more unique experiences of your life. That is to just open yourself up. You don't have to come in and believe anything, a single fucking thing that we cover. If you just think it's all ridiculous, you know what? That's fine, because we provide the kitschiness stuff and the laughing aspect of it as well, you know?
Yeah.
I want to, number one, provide a unique, fun opportunity that people locally that would have zero other chance of experiencing something like this can do, or someone that's really into it has a place that they can go and just feel, whether it be validation or acceptance or even just a kick out of that there's other people that kind of think like they do, you know?
Yeah.
That's number one.
I totally feel it.
Number two, to expand on that a little bit, we provide a location that has objects and thoughts and constructs of the mind from all over the world in a small town in Kentucky. So we are bringing mind expanding, whether or not it's serious, we are bringing things that expand your mind and make you think about things in entirely different ways than you ever would into a small town that has historically been sheltered away from the larger world and has turned away from the things that make you expand your mind. I am bringing a mini cosmos of mind expansion into this town that traditionally thinks extremely conservative. So if locals and people here that have never given a thought about what happens after you die, well, past the, well, Jesus takes you to heaven idea, or what else is out there in the world, or what else is out there in the universe, or what other types of life are there on this same planet that I coexist with, either peacefully or not peacefully. I bring that to a small town that, whether or not they realize it when they come through the museum, are exposed to these things, that even if it expands one person's mind and makes one person a little bit more accepting of other cultures and other ideas and other ways of life, then that has made a positive impact into the world. That's something that I think it almost, if I was a right-wing conspiracy theorist, I would call this the left-wing liberal agenda to change everyone's minds, because I am forcing people subconsciously to step out of their normal conservative thought process and think a little bit more about the wider world they live in.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is what right-wing conspiracy theorists accuse colleges of doing. They accuse Hollywood of doing. They accuse traveling of doing. And I am absolutely doing the exact same thing. Hmm. So if you're a super right-wing conspiracy theorist, you would be right in saying that I am somehow trying to further my personal globalist agenda. And by my personal globalist agenda, I mean making people expand their horizons even in the smallest way possible. Okay?
You son of a bitch.
I mean, people might, I would honestly think if that audio clip was picked up, there are some crazy people would think that this was nefarious, you know?
Yeah.
But I absolutely think that the more ways that any person can think about a problem, the more likely they are to overcome that problem in any sort of way, you know? Even if I'm just making you look at a bottle of Rougarou rum, you know? That still gets you thinking, well, someone cared enough about this made-up creature to devote money and an alcohol to it, maybe it is kind of important, you know?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I like that. I like it.
Yeah, I think so. Don't go out telling Alex Jones that I'm out here doing this, you know?
Yeah, well.
But I really think that it is a mini version of a four-year college, you know? That I'm making these people think in ways that they're not accustomed to. So that maybe, just maybe, they're going to open up their way, their mind and their heart just in the smallest way possible. Okay, so I think that that's extremely important. Third, this is much more tangible and normal. we have brought in to our local community over 15,000 visitors. Some of these people are locals, yes. But a lot of these people, have people from over 40 states, over 9 countries that have visited my museum. A lot of people that would have never even heard of Somerset if it wasn't for the International Paranormal Museum, and certainly would have never came or visited our downtown. While they're here, they're visiting my museum, they're visiting Jarfly, they're visiting Molehole, they're getting hotels. So I am absolutely helping the local economy. We've brought in hundreds of thousands of dollars. I don't know how much money we've made over 5 or 6 years. We haven't brought in a million, but we have brought in hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to this local economy, the vast majority of which gets pumped right back into our local economy, where we are giving money to the companies that are printing our shirts locally and printing our t-shirts locally, and rent and money to our Cooper Community Arts Center to help it keep on functioning, doing public events, sponsorships to local cheerleading groups and local middle school and high school sports. And we have sponsored CryptidCon for 5 or 6 years now in Lexington, that has become the largest cryptid conference in America. That's partially because of our sponsorship. You know, we have brought so much money, like tangible, accountable money, into not only our local economy, not only to the Art Center, but into Somerset and Kentucky as a whole, and has helped be part of the $8 billion economy of tourism, or whatever it is here, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that that's incredibly important. Lastly, I think that there's an absolute spiritual aspect. People get some sort of fulfillment in their quest for the other by coming to the museum and seeing these things, or knowing that there's people researching it, or watching our live streams, or listening to our podcast, or watching the documentaries that we're doing, consuming the other products. Darren and I are working on a ghost hunting device that we're eventually going to make a Patreon about and stuff. And people are consuming that. And we're helping create this community, influence this community that I have been a part of for years. I've been going to Mothman Festival for 9 years. And now if you go to Mothman Festival, in the very beginning, I'd go and I'd look at the cool shirts people were wearing and think, man, I want to get cool shirts like that. I want to make cool shirts. And now you go to Mothman Festival and you see the shirts that I've created and we've released through our museum all over. That's validation that we're creating this reverberance in the community that has helped create us. And now we're helping to shape it. And we're helping. I mean, if it wasn't for the museum, Pennyroyal, the podcast, probably would have still happened in some sort of aspect, but it certainly wouldn't have been brought up in Hellier, because if there was no museum, there would have been no contact for Greg, because I wouldn't have went to CryptidCon and known him personally. There's so much that we have brought and we have made happen in this local community and have made these lifelong lasting friendships and interactions and connections with people, that even if our museum was to disappear tomorrow, would absolutely never go away. But if our museum was to disappear tomorrow, that would mean that we wouldn't have the ability to continue these connections in the future.
Man, so, you know, we've talked about all the great things, you know, and now a controversy looms. Can you fill us in on everything that's happened, you know, in the last little bit here, like the last couple of months, I'd say, right?
Yeah, we've known that, you know, that there was a storm on the horizon for at least a year. Really, in the past 4 or 5 months, the weather's gotten bad for us. So our building, as I previously mentioned, started out as the post office for the community. In 1967, became the Pulaski County Library. In 2010, I believe, maybe 11, became the Carnegie Community Art Center, which just about 2 years ago went through the name change of the Cooper, the John Sherman Cooper Community Art Center. So our building was gifted in 1966 from the Pulaski County government to the Pulaski County Library. They were gifted the deed, and they ran it successfully until the library had a brand new building built in about 2010. They moved there, and then the idea was thrown around with what to do with the former library built. Our community used to previously have a big problem about knocking down historical buildings and was just finally coming around to not doing that when the library moved out. So there was a lot of talk on what to do with the building at that point. The main ideas were to turn it into a Pulaski County Museum or turn it into some sort of community art center. Now, at the time, we have what is now a national military park or a national monument here in our county. It's the Mill Springs Battlefield. At the time, it was owned by us. Trump actually, in his last year, signed it over to be a national property. Back then, in around 2010, the Mill Springs Battlefield Society had just gotten the money together and were in the process of building or had just completed their own museum. So it is in our county. It's about the Mill Springs Battle and about Cashmere Pulaski and all the good things that go along with our part of the Civil War. Because our community had just created a museum, they didn't want to go with a second museum in town. Absurd, I know. no one understands that you could have a billion museums because they all represent different things. You know, our community had just finished the military museum, so they weren't as gung-ho about the Pulaski County Historical Museum idea. In addition to that, our Pulaski County Historical Society maybe wouldn't be the best at running a museum. You know, they're a purely volunteer organization. There's a handful of them, and they all are very old. No one, they do not do a good job of reaching out to get younger members. So that idea was laid to the side, and instead, a concentrated effort was done by a committee that wanted to push for an art center. And they eventually won out. And two of the most important people on this art center board were Diane Giddens and Dan Dutton. Your listeners may be very familiar with Dan Dutton. He played a big part in Pennyroyal. He's a local artist here that is known nationwide. He's written operas that have been on PBS, KET. He has work that's in the National Library of Congress. He is well known. He has, you know, pieces on exhibit in museums in multiple places in the country. And he's local, and he was one of the biggest proponents, and eventually his voice won, along with Diane Giddens and the rest of the people on the board, and the Carnegie Community Art Center was born. So it was named the Carnegie Community Art Center because our town did in fact have an Andrew Carnegie Library at one point. Andrew Carnegie Foundation built the library onto our Somerset High School downtown, and it was one of only four Carnegie libraries that existed that were part of a school. Unfortunately, as I mentioned, our town was not great at preserving history. After the library moved from the Carnegie property into the property that my museum's in now in 67, that library wasn't used for anything, fell into disrepair, and in 1985 was torn down, which is just a big kick in the pants for us that we had a Carnegie property that our own idiocy caused us to lose, you know?
Yeah, it's a shame.
The library approved the idea for the Carnegie Community Arts Center. A lease was set up. The lease said that the Carnegie Community Arts Center organization would be responsible for the maintenance and upkeep of the building. And in repayment, we would be paying $1 a year in rent with an automatically renewed contract, a lease contract every year. This is how it had been set up from the very beginning. And this is still the lease we have currently. It has automatic renewal in September. And so we've never went through a process to get it approved or have it be denied and say that it was no longer ours. So as of I speak right now, March 2023, this is the lease that is still in place for our building. So the building became the Carnegie Community Arts Center. And one of those people mentioned, Diane Giddens, became the director of the facility. A board was established and they started running community programs and everything. They opened, I think, like I said, 2011. Well, in 2016, I became interested in, well, really all I wanted to do was set up a Halloween exhibit for some of my many items, haunted and cursed items and other things that now eventually are in the museum. I wanted to set up like a display case in a local community center, just kind of highlighting our stuff, you know, have it be part of the Halloween festivities and maybe get a newspaper article about it or something. The library at their new location said no. And a couple, the Historical Society said that we could, but they are in the basement of the library, of the new library, and like not a very visited area. So we were looking for other ideas. So eventually I walked into the Carnegie Community Arts Center. They were in the middle of a lot of renovations at the time. It took me 10 minutes to find anyone in the building that knew anything. And eventually I found who was the director at that point, Rhonda Wilford. The first director, Diane Giddens, had developed cancer and she had moved away. She had moved to South Carolina I'm not being cold or anything here. The narrative was she moved to South Carolina into her children's house to go die on the beach, you know, go die peacefully, live the rest of her life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert, that did not happen. That's going to play another chapter into some turmoil that we face. But she is out of the picture. Her protege, Rhonda Wilford, takes over. Rhonda's in charge for a couple of years before I enter the picture. I approach Rhonda with the idea. She says it's great, however, that they are in the middle of renovation, so they're not even open really at this time and blah, blah, blah. But through talking to her, I have eventually come up with the idea of having a full-time museum exhibit open. And at that stage, it was just going to be one room that was open to the public that had no admission and had no one staffed there. And like people could just walk through, like it was basically would be an art gallery, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the idea I proceeded with for a long time. And then eventually that developed into the full idea of a business, and the museum became what it is today. The International Paranormal Museum and Research Center, open 5 days a week to the public with an admission and an employee and a gift shop and everything that it is now. So success for us, right? However, in this whole time, there are several obstacles to overcome as the museum. First off, there's never been a business like that in this town. We're in the buckle of the Bible Belt. There was minimal pushback in that, but even without anyone actively working against us, it was hard to find people that would work with us. We eventually joined the Chamber of Commerce and got into enough local publications and state tourist stuff that we're a little bit more, you know, existing and accepted and had continued our natural growth. Then in October or sometime in late 2019, maybe September, the Hellier crew came. They filmed with us. Then that released on Black Friday. We could tell that was going to be a huge jump for us. The pandemic happened. So we closed for about 6.5 months. And in that time, we actually did a full remodel, invested over $10,000 in lighting and cases and information cards and everything, and reemerged in October of 2020 as the new and improved Paranormal Museum. Throughout this time, there have been several other things that have happened, such as the previous director that I had mentioned had not passed away and actually beat her cancer, which surprised everyone, including her doctors. And I was named the director of the Art Center. Rhonda Wilford left, and we had another interim director for about a month, and then the board approved me, and I ended up running the place for about 8 months. That was another handful of headaches, and eventually, at a board meeting, I said, listen, you board members aren't doing your jobs. Here's what I need out of you all. Either you accept this and delegate this work out, or you accept my resignation letter. And they chose to accept my resignation letter. And I was like, all right, that works. I can focus on the museum. At that point, of course, we were worried that the building is going to shut down now without a director or anything. Enter in Diane, the original director, came back, moved back from South Carolina. Her cancer's in remission. She's very old, and she decides she can still do this job. But she decides that the number one thing working against the Art Center is the quote-unquote business in the basement, the International Paranormal Museum. So she actively tries to kick us out for a while. That was about a six-month period where we didn't know if we were going to be allowed to stay there. Eventually, we won a public battle against her, and the board sided with us, so we were pretty safe in assuming we could stay. A few months later after that, she had run into enough other personal issues with people around here that a lot of it was based off of her battle with the museum, and she was eventually resigned and left. And we have new people in charge now that are doing great. Of course, we still need money to help run the building and everything. But everything is great, or so it seems, until the Pulaski County Library. Throughout, when I was the director, we had a strained relationship with the library, but a relationship. We would ask for this to be done for the building, and they'd send over their maintenance guy. And then the last big thing is we developed a leak in our roof, and they agreed to pay for it, which is normal because they are the landlords of this building. I want to point out at this point that, as I said, the lease did say we were responsible for the maintenance, and we as the organization took that as the maintenance you would be responsible for if you rented an apartment, changing the light bulbs, keeping it clean, stopping leaks, you know, doing things that would, like keeping an eye on things to make sure that they're not actually going to damage the property. If something happens, like the toilet breaks, the heat breaks, any of that, you call the landlord and then they take care of that and you go back to your regular maintenance. Apparently, that is not how the library has interpreted the lease. And when they paid for the roof, it was several thousand dollars. And they said that this is the last thing we're ever doing for you all. And we're like, oh, you're not doing this for us. You're doing this to protect your investment, the building, you know. That was kind of the beginning of the end of the relationship going well. When the board accepted my resignation letter instead of accepting responsibilities, I told the library, and the library had a lot of issues with the board. A few months later, Diane came back, and that basically was the end of all cordial interactions with the library, because Diane... she wasn't a very good people person. I'll just say that. I'm not trying to talk ill of anyone, even though she did personally attack myself and my museum several times when she was there. She wasn't good at doing, you know, being a people person, doing the social obligations you needed to get the things done that you really want, or even just putting up with things she didn't 100% agree with. So she left again, and the library would... The relationship with the library was completely fractured. They told us that they will never support us again, that they don't want us in the building, and that they're going to start looking at other options. And we're like, okay, that's fine. We have a lease. They let the lease auto-renew. They have never tried to evict us or anything. And then all of a sudden, a few months ago, our new director got a call from, I don't want to say her name, the person that's in charge of the library, and was told, we're coming in tomorrow with prospective buyers. You need to make sure that everything's unlocked and I can show them. And we're like, oh, well, that's interesting. And we tried to ask some questions. They refused to answer them. They showed the building and they were trying to get into tenants' locked, artists' locked office and stuff. And like our board said, absolutely not. These tenants would have to know. And they're like, well, we called you last night. And it's like, well, yeah, the lease says 48-hour notice. And so, like, that was the start of not just not being able to communicate, but active animosity between the two groups. They have decided that they are going to sell the building. Now, to go over this a little bit, our building is may or may not be on the national list of historic places. We have gotten confirmation from someone in Frankfurt that it is, that a whole block of our downtown was put onto the national list of historic places at one specific time, and that our building was included in that. However, actually finding any proof or documentation of that has been a lot more difficult than having one person confirm it over the phone. Whether or whether or not we're on the National List of Historic Places, it is still legally possible for the library to sell this building. Ethically, it's a little gray area that they were deeded this, and when they were gifted it, they were told it must always remain as something for the community, and now they're entertaining private buyers. That's a little bit ethically gray area, but legally, they have the ability to sell the building. The way that a public entity would have to sell a public building is two options. You hold a public auction where everyone that wants to put bids on is either there or has a representative, and the building is sold in that way. Or you do it with sealed bids and you accept whichever bid you would like. Under both ways, it is absolutely essential for the building to be sold at fair market value. If it's not sold at fair market value, then the entity selling it owes the remainder of the money to the community that they have let it not, that they've, you know, squandered. So our library has started entertaining private investors without a public announcement, which is another requirement. Behind the scenes, a private investor has offered $100,000 for our building, and the library told them yes if they could do cash. That is well below the fair market value. And in this whole time, the library has now been telling our board to start evicting everyone because they're selling the building. Now, again, we have a lease that auto-renews in September. They can choose to not auto-renew it, but it is good until September. And I have a personal lease that's good until January. Both of those are legally binding, though I don't know how strong either would be in a court case if a private investor were to buy the building and have expensive lawyers. I don't know how well these would work on as legs to stand on, you know?
Yeah.
But we do have them. And I absolutely would lean on it for everything that I could. So now the library, like I said, is we've had to show the building to potential buyers, I think, 3 or 4 times. We ended up going to the newspaper directly. We had a meeting. The Cooper board had a meeting with the former mayor of Somerset, who gave us a crash course on small town politics, on how to wage battles with public entities, specifically the library. Because specifically, the library has done things in the past that has greatly upset the community. By the library, I don't just mean the board. I mean this one woman in general, or in specific, that I am referencing for all of this. She is not a well-liked person in the community because of the things she has done and the questionable use of the people's tax dollars that she has done, you know? For instance, here's another thing we cannot get confirmed, but apparently around the time that the library moved into their new building, there was a public vote to where it was decided that I think 0.5% or 1% of what the library collected in taxes was to be specifically earmarked for the preservation of our building. That's something else. Multiple people have told us that that is how it's been. The library has absolutely not given us any confirmation. They've not given us any paperwork we've asked for. And we've been unable to find it through the county as of yet. If it's true that that tax like caveat was passed around the creation of our building and we never got a single year's worth of it, if we could get back pay, that would be probably $1 million or more. And it would be the amount of money that would cost to fix everything that the library has neglected to fix in our building, which has been broken pipes. It has been walls breaking from like moisture damage. It has been a complete shutdown of our HVAC and heating units, which would be hundreds of thousands of dollars to fix. And all of that would be able to be alleviated by this tax that was supposedly already earmarked for our building. It would not be an inappropriate use of the word to say the library has embezzled. If that truly, in fact, happened, that it was earmarked and then the library has kept it, that is the definition of embezzlement. So if we can get proof of that, that's yet another thing that would go in our favor. But the library thinks at this point we should be our failing arts organization that can sustain itself, but not the building that it's in, should be paying the hundreds of thousand dollars for air conditioning on their building while they're turning around and entertaining investors. So if we were able to come up with the money to fix our air conditioning at this point, why would we invest that? Because it would just be something that the library would say, oh, great, the air conditioning works. We can charge $700,000 instead of $600,000 now, you know?
Yeah.
There's zero incentive for us to spend one dime on that building that we love and care about and want to spend money on, because then the library will just take it from us, you know?
Wow. So sad.
So that's kind of what's going on. There's been public decrees from the Cooper Community Arts Center board saying we absolutely will not comply with any informal eviction. We absolutely do not approve of this. You as the community, if you care about your history, you need to make sure this doesn't happen. One of the rumors has been that one of the private investors that has looked at it wants to make it into a bar. And this is a building that has been the community hub for downtown Somerset since construction started on it, I think in 1904. It's absolutely unreal to think that this building that was the post office, then library, than the Arts Center that is still having, we do food drives for homeless people. We do free arts classes for children. We do concerts. We have free practice space for local bands, like youth in bands and local band organizations. We host the Lake Cumberland Choir for their practice space, who has no money and needs free practice space. We do all these things for the community, and as well as hosting my business, my livelihood, in the same way that we've hosted a theater program, a music center, and other businesses. Our building functions as an incubator for small businesses to get their start and then to be able to move to other places. And that's what my museum is trying to do. If we can move to another place, but unfortunately we're right in the middle of our whole downtown being gentrified. So every building is being bought up for 5 times what it's worth and 10 times what we could afford, you know? So we're stuck in this building that now the library is trying to shut down. And like I said, we have a lease till September for the arts organization, and I have a lease till January. But if a big fancy lawyer can overturn that, the museum could be out of a home next week, you know?
So it brings me to, and you've kind of answered the question, but it brings me to my first question would be, let's say that worst case scenario, they tell you, you know, you got to get out. Do you have a backup plan right now?
If I have to leave and the physical location of the museum is gone tomorrow, do I have a backup plan for a physical location? I have a couple backup plans, nothing that would be able to be implemented immediately, and nothing that would be ideal. Other than that, if there's no time frame, I have one or two very possible plans for moving to locations here downtown. One of them specifically I would like that would be a joint partnership with another friend that owns a business downtown, where we'd have about double the space we have and would be in our own building. That would be wonderful. However, if the museum has to shut down physical location, as I mentioned earlier, I want to start doing print-on-demand shirts for our monster series so that it's not dependent on our building. I want to immediately start a digital version of the museum to where I'm doing live streams, I'm talking about the objects, I'm doing things all in a way, hopefully, that wouldn't seem like I was ripping off Greg and Dana, because literally they're a traveling museum, unless you go see them at an event, is just an online museum where they do exactly what I would be doing, talking about the objects, having Q&As, doing Patreon memberships and all that. And I'd absolutely want it to be different content from what anyone else is doing. And I would want it to be a different format so it didn't look like I was just ripping off my friends, you know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, knowing you, I mean, I know that's not your MO, but I could see how it would, you know, how you would feel that you would appear that way to some people. I get it. My second question would be, is there anything that the general public, either in Somerset or otherwise, can do to help the situation? Is there any way that we can help fight not only to keep the museum alive, but to help, you know, your community with the Community Arts Center? I mean, is there anything that people can do? Because people are going to probably reach out and say, hey, what can I do to help?
Yeah. So right now we're working on an official petition. We're working on, so I'll tell you what the best case scenario is for the John Sherman Cooper Community Arts Center and the prolonged life of the building that we're in. That is, both of those are separate and equally valid concerns. If the library sells the building, more than likely the arts organization ceases to exist. And then there's a whole nother battle of, are these people going to tear the building down? Is it going to be used as some private bar or a house? Or what is going to happen to this building if it's sold? I do also want to mention the building is listed currently on Zillow for $600,000. The library never made a public announcement until our board went to the library and said, this is happening to us. Then our board went to the newspaper, excuse me, and said, this is what's happening to us from the library. Then the newspaper went to the library and released an article about everything. So that basically served as their public announcement of selling the building. Our best case scenario, we just had a new Pulaski County judge executive elected. And A county judge executive is basically like a mayor for the county instead of the city. And our new one's name is Marshall Todd. And Marshall Todd has been approached by our board, and we're trying to get him to agree to take the building back to ownership of the county instead of the library. Because the county gifted it to the library, and the library has the ability to gift it back to the county. In the newspaper, we specifically had the reporter ask the woman that's in charge of the library about it, and we got her to say in the newspaper that if the county asked for ownership of it back, that they could probably transfer it back. So our hope is that we can hold them to that, that the library will gift the building back to the Pulaski County government, and that the Pulaski County government will set aside tax dollars specifically for the maintenance of the building, so that that will allow us to continue our events and everything. We are working on the official petition right now to have people sign to have the Pulaski County Library gift it back to the county. We will, as soon as that's done, we'll share that on the John Sherman Cooper Community Arts Center Facebook page and the Paranormal Museum Facebook page. So that's going to be a huge thing once that's done. We're also working on some fundraiser Save the Cooper t-shirts and stickers. We're hopefully going to have those printed up in the next couple weeks. And we're going to be giving the stickers away, selling the t-shirts for probably $25, $30 to help raise funds for us.
What will that money specifically go towards, Kyle?
So that's going to go for money for PR marketing, and to get, we're trying to get a firm in Louisville to be our legal representation pro bono in case we cannot get them to. We may eventually need to establish a legal fund. I really hesitate to even think about that because that would be a lot of money. Otherwise, if we do not need the legal fund, it will go straight to PR and to fund more events for the community through the center, so that if the library does shut us down, we'll have all of those events canceled for the community. You know, we're actively trying to grow our reach so that not only we're doing more for the community, but so that it will be a larger impact if the library shuts us down, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So we're taking funds for, like I said, worst case scenario, legal, but more than that, for PR, to get more merch set up, to have like different campaigns. We're hoping to even, if we get enough money, we could hire someone to run the social media campaigns. And that would be amazing because everyone's doing this volunteer wise. And besides me, everyone else is like 60 and not the best at social media, you know?
So I understand. I understand completely.
So we're doing that. And even simpler than that, if you just follow the John Sherman Cooper Facebook page and want to like start sharing the stuff on there, that would be great. If you want to come to some of the events that we're going to be kicking up, we're going to be starting. This county has always had a battle of the bands every summer. And it's always been big because we've had a local music scene that's always been big. We haven't had one in for a few years. So we're going to start that back. And we're trying to get that going to be a big event in summer. We're going to try to do another arts fair. We're going to try to get all this stuff done with the support of the community, because it's for the community. And it's just more to highlight what we're doing that would be suddenly gone from the community if the building was gone. So that, get involved. If you want to even just get on Facebook, on the Pulaski County Library's Facebook, and say, please don't sell the building. Please gift it to the county. Please don't tear it down. Please don't put the Paranormal Museum out of business, like any of that stuff. Because, yeah, this is all right now I'm talking really monogamously from the larger picture. But this is also represents my livelihood. If they shut it down, the museum's gone. And I have other plans that maybe will work. But all of those things that I mentioned earlier that we do with the museum, whether it's bringing money in locally or helping to try to open people's lives and change the world in whatever small aspect we can, or even just to have a fun place to go to on a vacation. All that's in threat of being taken away from not only me, but from our community, from something that's way above our pay grade. it really affects. Like I said, we just made Roadside America. We plan on having hopefully 10,000 visitors this year. We hope to keep on expanding. We've been exposed to probably like 7 to 10 million potential visitors in the past 2 years from the different podcasts and documentaries and news news articles and different things we've been a part of. And all of that momentum in Rolling Stone would be completely halted if the library decides to sell the building. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Kyle, do you have anything else that you'd like to add before I cut you loose to go and get in a waiting list for one of these Save the Sherman Cooper Art Center t-shirts?
No, I mean, just number one, thanks so much for the support and everything. Number two, to your listeners, like, come visit the museum while it's still there. I'm banking pretty hard on the lease being good till September. So... I've started planning my 6 year anniversary party. Our 6 year anniversary is October 14th, and I'm already starting to plan for it. So I'm being optimistically cautious on all this stuff, but I can't make any promises. So if you want to come see the museum and haven't, please come do so. We're open Tuesdays through Saturdays, 11 to 5. Admissions, $4 adults, $3 children and seniors. We keep it dirt cheap because our rent is dirt cheap, which is one of the another community services that our building provides. Check out, we have our online store if you want to buy a t-shirt or magnet or something from us to throw us a little bit of support. We'd really appreciate it. And, you know, just keep an eye out for what the future is going to hold for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Kyle, I really hope that everything works out for you. Of course, I mean, I'm going to be in touch with you, you know, but it would be a tremendous loss, not only to weirdos like us, but to an entire community. And I would hate to see that happen, even though it's not my community. You know, it's a place I visit every single time I'm in town, and it's an institution for me. And I know I'm not the only one. So thank you for coming on and sharing all this information. Of course, people want to keep up with it. Go follow the museum. Go follow the Art Center on Facebook. I know Kyle's already posted, you know, a few newspaper articles and news items and everything. So make sure you stay up to date with that if it's of interest to you, and it should be. If you have the means and you have the time, go down to Somerset and go visit the stinking museum. I mean, we've been talking about it all day. Go visit, go say hi to Kyle and Hannah and pick up a t-shirt and wear it proudly through the downtown so people know that you're there to support a business that is inside of the Arts Center. And when the petition comes up, I will do my best to stay on top of it and get a link to it. I don't know. I mean, is a petition valid for people outside of the community, Kyle?
Yeah, it should be, especially we've talked about that in it. We want to word it to where we're not just, the center isn't just a value to the community, but to the community at large. You know, I'd absolutely think that out of town signatures on the petition would help prove that.
Very good. Absolutely. Kyle, if there's anything that I can personally do to help out, don't hesitate to ask, reach out, and if I can handle whatever it is you need, man, I'll be happy to do it.
I appreciate that, man. We may come to a point where we're taking all the help we can get, so I'm going to write down your name, and I may be coming for you.
Best threat ever. All of our archived episodes are available for free right now at patreon.com/beyondthepatio or on our YouTube channel. Follow us on social media. Give us a like if you don't mind. And if you have anything weird happen to you and you want to share the tale, hit me up at paranormalpatio@gmail.com.